It was a beautiful August day in the village of Millery, about 300 miles south of Paris. The bees swarmed, flowers bloomed, the sun shone, and it freaking stank. One local noblewoman cursed the stench as she climbed into her carriage on the way to church. Villagers first noticed the odors about a month before in July, but no one could agree on what it was and where it came from. Some gossiped that travelers had left some sort of animal carcass on their way through, but others argued it was probably some other animal that died and got caught rotting by the Rhone River. As the Comtesse departed and got closer to church, the stench worsened, making her sick to her stomach, and then it became so overwhelming she passed out. When the Comtesse regained consciousness, she decided enough was enough. She ordered her valet to do something about the stink. Her valet passed the baton to a local road mender named Dennis Coffey, who proclaimed, "I'll find what stupidity could smell this way," but then procrastinated another 2 days before he went out to follow his nose to the smell. It took him to the river, then along a road that climbed to a precipice. There was a guardrail to keep passing carriages safe, but beyond that was a steep embankment crowded with brush and wildflowers. Coffey used his pruning knife to hack away at the brush until the odor was overwhelming. When he spotted a large sack stuck in a bush and swarmed with flies, Coffey realized he found the source of the stench that had plagued the village of Millery since July. Coffey returned with a local cop in tow before slicing open the bag. Their eyes went straight to the human head inside, the first piece of flesh in the bundle that they could actually tell was human. The decaying head was wrapped in a black oilskin cloth, and further poking at the bundle revealed the rotting carcass of a naked man, tied up in the fetal position. Coffey and the policeman lugged the entire sack up the embankment before looking inside once more to see if they could recognize the man. They couldn't, though, and wondered if they would recognize him even if they knew him, since the face had deteriorated so badly. The head was swollen and black and lacked both eyes and a nose. The men threw some brush on top to hide the sack and then rushed into town for more assistance. The Millery Mystery had begun. I'm your host, Elise, and this is Old Blood, the historical true crime podcast. The autopsy on the Millery Unknown was conducted the following morning on August 14, 1889. The experienced medical examiner was out, so the case was handled by the professor's young student Paul Bernard, who did his best, but his lack of experience prevented him from determining too much about the corpse. Much of its internal organs were gone, and Bernard noted the brain resembled semi-liquid boiled meat. And now I will never again eat meat. Bernard's best guess was that the man had been between the ages of 35 and 45 when he died, and had died about 3 to 5 weeks earlier. He guessed the victim was about 5'7", about 165 pounds, and had black hairs on his head and beard, which fell away at the touch. Bernard hypothesized that the man had been reasonably well off, judging by his manicured nails and the pasta in his stomach. From the wounds on the corpse's neck, to breaks in the larynx, it appeared as though this man had been strangled to death by hand. The following day, a farmer was out collecting snails to eat, or escargot if you want to be French about it, when he stumbled upon some large scraps of wood. He moved to collect them as firewood until he got close enough to realize how badly the wood reeked of death. Having heard the news of the Millery corpse, as everyone in town had at that point, the farmer alerted the authorities, who collected the wood as evidence. The boards had once been part of a large trunk. 2 days later, road mender Dennis Coffey found himself back at the scene, standing around the guardrail when he looked down to find something shiny. It was a key. He gave it to the police, who tried it in the lock that was collected from the trunk pieces 2 days earlier, and they found it a match. Authorities were then able to theorize that whoever dumped the body used the key to open the trunk and dropped the key in doing so. The body was then dumped from the trunk over the embankment, probably hoping the corpse would tumble into the river where it would decay more quickly. And then they must have taken the trunk with them further down the road before trying to get rid of that evidence too by throwing it over the cliff. In Paris, France's finest detective was working a missing persons case when he read in the papers of the Millery corpse. The man the detective was searching for had been missing since mid-July. If these reports were correct, then the timeline fit his missing persons case perfectly. The man disappeared mid-July too, and that's when the people of Millery began to smell the stench that filled the town. His missing man could have been rotting away in Millery all this time. But when the detective inquired about the corpse, he was dismayed. Whoever the man was had black hair, whereas the missing man's was a chestnut color. His missing man was also slightly older and slightly shorter than what the autopsy had uncovered. The detective was chief of the Sûreté, or the police's investigative branch in Paris. Chief Marie-François Goron was the most epically French man I have ever seen. His mustache was France itself. I will be sure to post a photo for you to see. Goron was known as the French Sherlock Holmes for his notoriety in solving crimes. One of his greatest traits was his perseverance, his willingness to work until the job was done, and his stubbornness, his unwillingness to give up when he had a hunch. He was a unique man. He disliked violence and refused to carry a gun on him, though he always had a magnifying glass on hand. He was a workaholic, obsessed with detection, and fascinated by all the scientific advances that made his job easier. Goron was tough, but fair. He pursued criminals relentlessly, but still emphasized having respect for all, his inferiors included. He was known to feed hungry-looking suspects that he brought into the station. Goron may have been tough on crime, but that was because he cared, genuinely cared about other people. Seeing the people of his city living in squalor and crime moved him to action. He had a soft spot open even to criminals, knowing that much of the time, all that separated his life from theirs was mere luck. Goron was handed the missing persons case in July of 1889, when the man's co-worker and brother-in-law reported that he never made it home one night. The man was named Toussaint-Augustin Gouffet, and he was a bailiff. Here in the U.S., a bailiff is more of a menial position, but then in France it was comparable to that of an attorney. Gouffet, as bailiff, served as a sort of bill collector, having to inform clients of fees they owe and helping to collect them, so he was often in touch with the seedier side of Paris. And as someone who handled a lot of money, Goron wondered if this played any part in his disappearance. Gouffet's family claimed that he would not just disappear voluntarily. His wife had died years before, leaving him to care for his three daughters. Gouffet's housekeeper knew something was wrong immediately when she entered the bailiff's bedroom to see his bed still unmade. Gouffet was an infamous skirt chaser and was always out at nights, but he was also always back in bed by sunrise so that he could wake and have breakfast with his daughters. The maid tried to cover for Gouffet by making it seem as though he came home the night before, by messing up the bed a bit, but she couldn't keep his absence a secret for long. She eventually told Gouffet's brother-in-law that he was missing, who contacted a man named Launay. Launay was a tough guy who worked with Gouffet when he had to go collect debts. Detective Garon was quite interested to hear Launay's dramatic response to being told Gouffet was missing. He flung his hand across his heart and grew pale, gasping, "You did not have to announce it in such a brutal manner. Heart patient that I am, I could have just dropped dead." But Launay insisted he had nothing to do with the disappearance and that authorities should be looking elsewhere. Gouffet was easy prey, but not for him, for the ladies. The bailiff had gone around bragging how he had slept with 24 women in 1 month. Indeed, in the first week of his investigation, Garon had questioned 20 women who claimed they had sex with Gouffet in the month of July. This made Chief Garon's case far more difficult, as it widened the pool of suspects significantly. Any of these women, or the men they were associated with, could have waylaid and killed Gouffet for his money. It also did not help matters that the city of Paris was flush with visitors at the time. The French were commemorating the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution by hosting a massive world's fair, the International Exposition. The centerpiece of the expo was the highest man-made structure in the world at that time, Gustave Eiffel's 1,000-foot tower. It was the Belle Époque. Those of you who heard the tea or homicide episode on Henriette Caillaux may remember this as the beautiful age, as it is directly translated. The era just before the outbreak of World War I, between about 1871 and 1914. It was an era of optimism and creativity, just before an era of misery and death. The World's Fair in Paris and all of its extravagances exemplify this period well. Everything was a show then, including murder. As such, newspapers in Paris functioned very much like the yellow journalism of the United States during the time. Stories were sensationalized to sell as many copies as possible. In France, just as in the US, murder sold, and it sold well. Thus, the disappearance of Gouffet did not go unnoticed by the Parisian press, nor did the Millery corpse that was discovered near Lyon. Newspapers covered the case, which was quickly dubbed La Malle Sanglante, the bloody trunk. Inspector Garon was certain that the missing bailiff Gouffet had come from the bloody trunk near Lyon, but the newspapers were certain that Garon was making a fool of himself by insisting the two cases were connected. Garon discovered the Millery trunk had a baggage label signifying it had once been on the Paris-Lyon-Marseille railway. The label read July 27th, 1880, and then the last digit was illegible. Garon was certain the year was theirs, 1889. Gouffet disappeared just before July 27th, and then, weeks later, a stench filled Millery in exactly the amount of time it would take for Gouffet's corpse to decay and stink up the village. Authorities in Millery claimed the date was a year earlier, but Garon didn't believe this. But he did have to admit that there were certain aspects of the case that threw him off, like the fact that the Millery corpse had black hair, while Gouffet's hair was a distinctive chestnut color. Garon decided it was probably best to send someone who knew Gouffet well to see if they could ID the corpse. Gouffet's brother-in-law ended up traveling to Millery, and after a quick look at the very decomposed body, he declared that it was not Gouffet, mostly because the hair was black as coal. It couldn't be the bailiff. And so the inspector continued to investigate in Paris. Goron put Inspector Jaume on the case, one of his best detectives and a respected sidekick of sorts. Jaume believed Goron's hunch that the two cases were connected and followed the path Goron sent him on diligently. "I said to myself," Jaume explained, "that's Gouffet's cadaver there. I bet the universe against a bunch of carrots." Jaume wound up re-interviewing Launay, the tough guy that worked with Gouffet, and freaked out when he heard the bailiff was missing. The night before his disappearance, Gouffet was overheard arguing with Launay over 80,000 francs he owed. The men were at a cafe when the usually quiet bailiff began shouting at Launay. When Gouffet went missing, so did his ledger of debts, and Launay suddenly had money on him. Launay did have a solid alibi, so Jaume knew he couldn't push too hard, but he did tell Launay, "It is well proven that you didn't take part in this crime, but you could have profited from it. That would have put some butter in your spinach." Gotta love these weird-ass phrases the French used. I tried to include as many of them as possible in this episode because they crack me up. Launay was in an entirely different town the day of Gouffet's appearance. And, as Jaume joked, going from one person to the next as if to say hello to the whole town. And then he attended a meeting at the Gymnastic Society from 8 to 10 p.m. So, no, Launay did not disappear Gouffet, and he wanted the authorities off of his back, sketchy guy that he was, so he pointed them elsewhere. "You know who else disappeared at the same time as Gouffet?" Launay asked Goron. "A man by the name of Michel Ayrod." Michel Ayrod was a superb con man, a swindler of the first order. He was charismatic, though, and that's what made him successful. He saw himself as a raconteur, a teller of grand stories so moving he had his audience sitting on the edge of their seats. He was a schmoozer, too, a ladies' man. He knew how to charm people into doing what he wanted them to do, and fooled men and women equally. Michel was a skilled con artist, but he also was not the best decision maker. Stephen Levingston is the journalist who wrote the book about this case, Little Demon in the City of Light, and he commented on Michel Ayrod, quote, "His wrecked life was a testament to his blind pursuit of ill-advised schemes," end quote. For us, Michel's story begins in the 1860s, when he was serving in the French army. His passion for women had him sneaking out of the camp against orders to go on a date. This move got him arrested for desertion, also for stealing an army horse to commit said desertion. When Michel was finally granted amnesty in 1869, he moved to Paris, where he married and had a daughter. But Michel wasn't built for the family life, so he took the 40,000 franc dowry he was settled with upon marrying his wife, and then deserted her and his child. By 1871, Michel was in Argentina, conning people by pretending to be the personal business emissary of the exiled Napoleon III. He made several thousand francs from this before having to flee for Paris. He then returned to South America, where he lived and worked until the 1880s, when he was fired for dishonesty and then went back to France. Inspector Jaume had a realization after speaking with Gouffet's co-worker Launay. Michel Ayrod, 45, was one of the businessmen who met with Gouffet just before his disappearance. Gouffet's sidekick Launay was also at the meeting, held at Café Gutenberg, and he remembered Gouffet stopping Michel before he even sat down, saying, "I don't know if I should drink with you since you've gone bankrupt." But Michel explained to Gouffet that it wasn't him who went bankrupt, it was the company he worked for, and the three dined uneventfully after that. Detectives inquired with Michelle's household, who explained that he was out the night of the 26th, came home around 1 a.m., and then left early at 7 in the morning. Michelle's wife said this was usual for him, since he was always off with some woman or another. Lanne had more specific details. Michelle's current mistress was a 21-year-old named Gabrielle Bompard. Unlike Michelle, Gabrielle came from a well-to-do family living in Lille, near the border of Belgium, though she also did not live the best life. She was 5 when her mother died, and was then shipped off to live with her uncle while her father began a relationship with the family governess, causing quite the scandal. But instead of giving up his mistress, Gabrielle's father gave up Gabrielle when the mistress wished her gone. She was then sent to a convent where she began to rebel against authority, and was sent home after only a year. For the next few years, her father struggled to find schools and convents to ship his daughter off to, after she kept being asked to leave for behavior issues. She returned home at 18 with a note that her father should keep a close eye on her. According to Lovingston, Gabrielle was then, quote, a volatile, independent-minded teenager in love with fashion and eager for the spotlight, end quote. She fought with her father's mistress until she warned that Gabrielle would be sent off to a convent once more. Rather than be imprisoned again, Gabrielle, 20 and alone, took a train to Paris. The young runaway Gabrielle arrived in Paris in 1888, out of money and looking for a job, when she found herself in front of the trading office of Michel Ayrode. Gabrielle was at first thankful for the opportunity, grateful that this man had taken her off the streets and given her a job. But the relationship grew abusive quickly. Gabrielle later said of him, "This man, the way he looked at me, he stole my free will." Michelle assumed control of her life and began to pimp her out for money. Michelle himself was still married with a daughter, so Gabrielle remained his mistress, but he fed and clothed her and paid her rent. On one occasion, Gabrielle tried to run away, but he dragged her back and nearly strangled her to death. She begged his forgiveness, which she gave, but walked around with red marks on her neck for days afterward. Gabrielle Bompard had been living with Michel Ayrode for about a year, helping with his various scams until they learned of a bailiff, who regularly went around with a bunch of cash on him and had a soft spot for women. He was a bailiff by the name of Toussaint Augustin Gouffet, and regularly departed his office with a bunch of money. He also had a very noticeable crush on Gabrielle. As Goron and Jaume learned about Michelle and Gabrielle, they became certain that they were on the correct path. The two visited the man's home, but the wife informed them that he was not there and hadn't been for weeks. He wasn't even on the same continent. He was working in Brazil. With their prime suspects missing and the press mocking them for believing the Millery corpse was that of Gouffet, despite the contradictions, the investigators grew stressed. Jaume noticed Garonne's anxiety one day, noting, "I see that Garonne's mustache has lost its symmetry." The two lucked out when a more cooperative investigating judge took office in Lyon and agreed to send the baggage label found on the destroyed trunk. The bag had departed on July 27th, exactly the day Gouffet was reported missing. The detectives began searching the railway bag registry by year. They found no match in 1887, which was the year that the other Lyon detectives claimed the label read. But they did find one in that year, from July 27th, 1889. There was a match for one trunk weighing 105 kilos, or about 230 pounds. The trunk had been large and very heavy. Refusing to bow to skeptics, Garonne and Jaume set off for Millery to prove the connection between the corpse and Gouffet. They wanted to dig him up. They wanted a new autopsy. The only problem was that with the corpse unidentified, it had been buried in a sort of potter's field with the other unknown dead. They knew the original autopsy had been done by an inexperienced medical examiner, but when they spoke to the young man, Paul Bernard, they were surprised by his intelligence. He may not have done the best job on the autopsy, but Bernard did have the foresight to not only save some tufts of the man's hair, but he also left an old hat of his on the corpse, just in case someone wanted to dig the man back up. This news delighted Garonne to no end, and he handed Bernard 500 francs from the reward fund that Gouffet's daughters had set up, and then went to test the hairs. With as much patience as he could muster, Garonne began to clean the hairs with some distilled water and a soft brush. As the blood and substances of decomposition washed off, Garonne found himself looking down at chestnut-colored hair. The corpse's hair wasn't black, it was dirty. The chief sent a telegram to Paris asking his detectives to retrieve a brush with Gouffet's hair from his home in order to compare samples. Garonne wanted to be sure the hairs were a match by comparing their thickness. And, just as he suspected, both hair samples were the exact same thickness. On November 11th, the state prosecutor relented and ordered the unknown buried in Millery to be exhumed. The autopsy was to be performed by the man who was originally supposed to do it, the renowned professor Dr. Alexander Lacassagne. He was already France's premier forensic scientist, according to Levingston. But his work on the Millery corpse, quote, would rank as a landmark in forensic medicine, end quote. The autopsy took 3 days to complete. Lacassagne was a perfectionist who left no room for doubt, so his processes took him quite some time, but there was also the fact that the body was insanely decayed by this point. The corpse was already falling apart when it was discovered, and the second autopsy took place about 4 months later. Lacassagne had even more decay to deal with, along with the messy, haphazard way the previous autopsy had been done. Yet, despite all this, Lacassagne was able to determine, in 3 days, who the corpse was. He performed Garonne's hair test by cleaning off the hairs to reveal their original color, and then went a step further to test for dyes. There were none, and the hairs were 0.13 millimeters in diameter, the same as Gouffet's hairs. The doc then set to looking at the bones. Lacassagne began measuring them to determine the body's height, which he revised to a half inch taller at 5 feet 8 inches, Gouffet's height. He then revised the corpse's age from 35 to 45 to 45 to 55 years old. Gouffet had been 49. Lacassagne also observed the body's teeth and conferred with Gouffet's dentist. Both Gouffet and the corpse had a missing molar in the upper right side of the jaw. Dr. Lacassagne noticed that the corpse showed signs of the man having a bad right leg. Gouffet's family claimed that he too had a bad right leg after a childhood incident in which he fell. He suffered leg pains and inflammation since. Gouffet's doctors confirmed that he had a bad right leg, and even his cobbler was contacted and stated that he always made a special right shoe for Gouffet, with an extra wide heel and soft leather so as to not exacerbate his attacks of arthritis and gout. La Cassagna speculated the man would have had a slight limp while alive. Gouffet also walked with a slight limp. Dr. La Cassagna tested everything he possibly could before turning to investigators. "Gentlemen," he announced, "I herewith present you with Monsieur Gouffet." Caron and Jaume had been incorrect in their hunches that the Millery corpse and Gouffet were one in the same, and reveled in the "I told you so" after so many months of being mocked as fools. Still, Garonne wasted no time in celebrating his victory. In one of the more sensational scenes of this case, the chief ordered the bloody trunk restored to see if anyone could identify it. Garonne needed to find where the trunk came from, hoping it would reveal a connection between Gouffet, the trunk, and their prime suspects, Michel Ayrod and Gabrielle Bompard. When reconstructed, Garonne had the trunk placed on display at the city morgue. He selected the morgue because it was common then for people to walk in and look about at the unknown men and women found dead in the streets of Paris, both to identify them and as a means of satisfying their curiosity and providing a form of entertainment. Instead of swiping through their phones, they like to file past corpses just to see what's up. So yeah, the morgue was a sort of gallery at times, a means of helping detectives solve crimes and missing persons cases. Within 3 days, 25,000 people filed in to see the bloody trunk, setting the city of Paris ablaze. People in cafes across Paris raised their glasses to toast La Main Sanglante, the bloody trunk. Visitors could even purchase souvenirs at the morgue of mini-trunks. Finally, someone informed authorities that the trunk must have been made in England, for the measurements were based on the English yard, not the French meter. The nails used also resembled English nails. A man named Georges Charon was a Frenchman living in England, and told investigators that the trunk had come from Euston Road, in London. The couple the police were searching for, Michel and Gabrielle, had actually rented a room from him while in London, some weeks before Gouffet's disappearance. She stayed for 2 days and had a trunk just like the one on display at the morgue. Charon remembered the man being very abusive toward the woman. On one occasion, the two were at a saloon when Michel tried to put on a show by hypnotizing Gabrielle. She didn't want to and tried to shoo him off, but Michel beat her. Garonne and Jaume decided to visit London themselves to be certain. They learned the trunk was from a company called Zwanziger's, and they were able to ID it because it featured two characteristics that only Zwanziger trunks had: a blue-starred interior lining, and a manufacturer's notch on the lock. The trunk company told the detectives that the trunk was sold on July 11th to a man resembling Michel Ayrod. Garonne and Jaume were now absolutely certain that the Millery corpse was Gouffet, and that Gouffet was connected to the missing couple Michel and Gabrielle. The manhunt for them had already begun, but before long, authorities found their jobs had been made far easier by an appearance at the station. It was Gabrielle Bompard. Gabrielle Bompard appeared at the prefecture on January 21st, 1890, along with a man that was not Michel Ayrod. The man was Georges Garanger, one of Michelle's intended victims and Gabrielle's current lover. Gabrielle finally escaped the abuse of Michelle after the two fled France for America. When Michelle told Gabrielle of his plans to swindle and kill Garanger, whom Gabrielle had developed feelings for, she confessed to Garanger the truth of who she was and what she had done. She painted herself the victim, which would be discussed in length in the trial to come, saying that Michelle had kept her in a life of sin and crime. Garanger felt for Gabrielle and told her the wisest thing to do was to turn herself in and explain her side of the story. She was the victim here, and though she was in a tough position, he argued that her innocence would win out in the end, once she had time to explain herself and people heard her story. With her name in newspapers across the globe, Gabrielle probably felt as though it were only a matter of time before someone found her anyway, so she agreed with her new beau Garanger that she should turn herself in and be honest. They attempted to when getting back to Paris, but was turned away at the station by probably the one man in the city who did not recognize her or her name. So she returned the following day, when Inspector Jean arrested her. Parisians did not react to Gabrielle as Garanger had. Sure, a sizable chunk of them believed her the innocent dupe of an evil and abusive man, but a large part of the population saw her as guilty. Levingston attempted to describe many Parisians' scorn for Gabrielle by arguing, "A woman her age ought to have been sweet and demure," but Gabrielle ignored the norms. She was France's greatest fear, a woman on the loose, a dangerous murderess, a threat to the stability of the French family. And precisely for all that, Parisians found her tantalizing. They may have hated her, but they also loved to hate her. She was an immediate sensation. The papers exploded with news of the alleged murderess and dove into all the details of the mystery and her role in them. Reporters quoted her every word and commented on each outfit she clothed herself in. Novelist Émile Zola even commented on Gabrielle, saying, "She is, quote, delighted to know that her name is in the newspapers every day," end quote. Her erratic behavior further sensationalized the case, with many claiming she suffered from hysteria, or female mania. There were times when she was detached and quiet, but almost as though she were separated from the reality of her situation. She often made strange remarks about the case, like how Michelle had tied up Gouffet like a chicken after killing him. She often did not grasp just how serious things were, but just when Gabrielle seemed completely disconnected, she would become impassioned. La Presse wrote, "She interrupts herself to laugh without reason, and these outbursts of mad hilarity last several minutes." Inspector Jean, however, disagreed. "To embarrassing questions, she responds with a burst of laughter," he explained. "This woman is not a scatterbrain. She thinks. She calculates. She has extreme self-possession and audacity. A cunning devil, yes. A fool, no." Garon was also not falling for Gabrielle's narrative, later saying, "La belle Gabrielle recounted a new fact to the judge every day, which was often a lie, but also sometimes a confession." Gabrielle's narrative of Gouffet's murder, though later contested in court, goes like this. On the 26th of July, 1889, Michelle and Gabrielle were in their rented first-floor apartment on 3 Rue Tronson du Coudray, setting the stage. The couple cleared the room of all seats save for one chaise lounge, which they shoved into a corner of the room in front of some curtains. Behind the curtains, there was an alcove in which Michelle had installed a pulley system onto the ceiling, complete with a rope hanging to the floor next to a wooden chair. Waiting in the kitchen, a large brown trunk. Gabrielle, from her time in the convents, was good at sewing, so she was asked to create a man-sized sack. She was following orders, she said. She didn't know what Michelle was asking her to do, only that she had to listen or face the consequences. Michelle then coached his actress Gabrielle through what she was about to do that night, feeding her lines and walking her through the timing of things. Gabrielle was to be the sexual bait, as Levingston described it. Toussaint Augustine Gouffet was then dining on the terrace of Café Verde on one of Paris's busiest boulevards. He was dining on absinthe and a pasta with beans and carrots, and sporting a silk hat, monogram shirt, and a gold pinky ring set with a sapphire and ringed by diamonds. The three friends he was dining with were trying to convince Gouffet to join them on their excursion to the International Exposition, but he declined without going into detail why. Gouffet had a very important date to attend. Earlier, he had run into Michelle Ayrode, associate of his associate, Launay. Michelle put on a show at seeing him, then confided in the bailiff that he was over and done with his mistress, Gabrielle. Michelle hinted that he knew Gouffet had a thing for Gabrielle and suggested he pay her a visit. He wasn't too surprised by this, as he had dined with a couple just the day before, and Gabrielle also told Gouffet that she was getting tired of Michelle and was going to leave. Gouffet bid Michelle goodbye, and then continued on with his day, only to then run into Gabrielle herself. "So is it true what you confided in me?" he asked her. "Who told you?" Gabrielle asked. "I just saw him. He even gave me your address." "Ah," she replied. "Then come see me tonight." At around 8, Gouffet said goodbye to his friends and went to Gabrielle's apartment. He entered to find the gas jets lowered in the apartment at 3 Rue Tronson du Coudray, candles lit and a setting of cognac and biscuits. And then there was Gabrielle, petite at only 4'8" and dressed in a silk dressing robe. "So, little demon," Gouffet turned to Gabrielle. "We have left Michelle?" She said she had, and Gouffet then headed for the chaise in the corner of the room, taking a seat. Gabrielle climbed onto his lap and began playing with the red cord tied around her waist. "It was very expensive," she told him. "It was a special sash," she said, untying it to reveal her nudity underneath. Gouffet began to fondle and kiss Gabrielle as she knotted the cord and passed one end of it through the curtain to Michelle, who fastened it to the rope and the pulley. She held the sash up to him and exclaimed, "What a nice necktie it would make for you!" She then lifted the sash up to his head to place around his neck, but then hesitated. She couldn't do it. Yet before Gouffet sensed anything was amiss, Michelle pushed himself through the curtains and flung the noose around the bailiff's neck and began to tighten it by pulling the rope through the pulley. Gouffet rose in the air as Michelle pulled on the other end of the rope, and the bailiff began choking and growing pale. But suddenly there was a large snap, and Gouffet fell to the floor. Michelle flung himself onto Gouffet and plunged his thumbs into his neck as he strangled him. When Gouffet was finally still, Michelle turned to Gabrielle, saying, "It's done." Michelle downed the bottle of cognac set out for Gouffet and then forced himself onto Gabrielle, beside the man he just strangled to death. The two searched Gouffet but did not find the expected money on him, so Michelle took his keys and headed for Gouffet's office. The 14,000 francs were still sitting on Gouffet's desk from that day, but Michel did not see them in his hasty search for riches. In the end, Michel made off with Gouffet's hat, pinky ring, gold watch and chain, a 50-franc note, a 100-franc gold coin, and a tortoiseshell nose clip. The price of Gouffet's life. Michel needed an alibi for himself, though, so he made his way back home to his wife at 1 a.m., leaving Gabrielle behind with the corpse for the night. He returned early the next morning with some help and a horse-drawn cab. He and his ignorant associate carried a large trunk from the apartment and hauled it onto the carriage, which then set off for Lyon. When the couple arrived in Lyon, several men, including a housekeeper, helped Michel with the trunk. The housekeeper was dismayed to find that his hands and apron had been stained with a sticky, wine-colored substance that he assumed was paint or wine, not realizing the role he played in moving the infamous bloody trunk. Michel, wearing the silk hat stolen from Gouffet, directed the carriage to a cliff high above the Rhone River, then lugged the trunk down and shoved it over to the precipice. He tilted the trunk, letting the body inside the burlap sack tumble out and down the cliffside. He then smashed the trunk to pieces and flung them over a cliff a few miles down the road. The couple then traveled to Marseille, where they spent some time with Michel's brother at the Arode family vineyard that Michel had managed to bankrupt in the past. They stayed until they realized they had to get out of the country. By this point, Gouffet's disappearance had hit the press, so Michel and Gabrielle knew the police were investigating already, but there was no word of them yet, nor the apartment that was the scene of the crime. Michel thought it would be cool to steal Gouffet's hat after killing him and accidentally left behind his own hat. Michel kept obsessing over his lost hat out of fear that someone would connect it to him, so before leaving Europe, the two returned to Paris to the scene of the crime. Michel retrieved his hat, lucky that the police did not yet know about the apartment, and then sailed across the Atlantic Ocean. The fugitives found themselves in Vancouver, New York, and then finally San Francisco. On their way to England to board the ship to Canada, the duo posed as father and son. Gabrielle chopped her hair off and began wearing boys' clothing. She was an extremely petite woman as it was, at only 4'8", so she fit in as a child quite easily. By the time they reached North America, Gabrielle was posed as the blonde girl, Bertha, traveling with her father, a Mr. Van Nerd. They met the French businessman Georges Garanger in Vancouver. Michel was posing as a cognac merchant heading to San Francisco to scout the scene and establish a distillery there. He suggested that Garanger join them there in California to invest in the project, to which Garanger agreed. He was interested in the booming California wine business that Michel had painted for him, but he was also interested in the vintner's beautiful young daughter. The daughter, too, became interested in Garanger, who was a kind reprieve in the midst of Michel's abuse. Gabrielle grew a soft spot for Garanger and began to hope that he would save her and take her away from Michel. "I am certainly grateful to him," she explained of Michel, "but to love him? Never. Poor man. He lives on illusions." Her ire for Michel grew as he began his con with Garanger. Michel told him they could make a fortune by shipping California cognac to France and offered Garanger in on the business before it really took off. All Garanger had to do was give Michel 2/3 of the capital needed to begin, and then he would eventually profit the same amount. The amount Michel asked for was about $5 million in today's money. Surprisingly, Garanger agreed and signed the contract Michel had forged for the imaginary distillery. But then, there was an emergency. The vintner's young daughter had to go back to France immediately because her rich aunt had died, but Michel needed to stay in California for business. He wondered if Garanger would escort his daughter back to France. But the daughter, who was really Gabrielle, had fallen in love with Garanger and confessed all on their voyage back. She told Garanger that Michel was conning him out of his money and planned to kill him. And not just that, but he had murdered before. And worse, forced Gabrielle to be his accomplice. It was worse than Garanger thought, too. Michel had hypnotized Gabrielle into committing the act of murder for him. She confessed that it had always been quite easy to put her into a trance. Hypnotism was quite the fad at the time, so this was not too unusual for him to hear. On their ship to Britain, Garanger himself tried putting Gabrielle into a trance, hoping it might help her, but she only began to burst into hysterics once hypnotized. "Murderer! Murderer!" she yelled. The businessman believed her completely and did what he thought was best to save Gabrielle from legal action against her. He convinced her to turn herself in and tell the truth about what happened to the bailiff Gouffet. People would see the truth, that Michel was an abusive and controlling man who forced Gabrielle to do his bidding. Garanger stuck by Gabrielle's side and hired lawyers for himself and her defense. And Gabrielle, meanwhile, was confessing all to authorities that mostly did not believe her. "I am not aware of any sentiments that I wrote inspired in me," she told them. "It was fear, that's all. He disgusted me." But Michel, still in hiding, wrote furious messages to the couple that had deceived him. To Gabrielle, he tried to guilt-trip her into returning, and to Garanger, he wrote, "This woman, she is mine. I gave her my fortune and my honor. She does not have the right to be happy while I suffer." And then came the threats. "I promise you, you will lose her and perhaps yourself. I am not making any threat. I pose conditions. Return her, and I will pardon her." He even wrote to Chief Goron, a long missive filled with misogynistic and anti-Semitic rants. He told him that Gabrielle was the most sly woman in the world, and that he had to capture her and Garanger, but that he was innocent and wouldn't return to France to pay for a crime he did not commit. For the most part, it was the ravings of a madman, desperate at his loss of control over Gabrielle, and hell-bent on revenge. It was not long before a Frenchman living in Cuba wrote to the French consul that he believed he had found Michel Ayrault there, again trying to scam people out of their money. When Havana authorities finally arrested him and put him in jail, he smashed his glasses to pieces and used them to cut himself. He was okay, ultimately, but from that point forward was closely watched all the way back to Paris. After a year of chasing the murderer, Chief Goron finally met Michel Ayrault at the train station. And now, the show was to begin. This is the end of a two-part episode, and because it's a two-part episode, I will release the second part in 2 weeks rather than three, so yay. Be sure to return in 2 weeks for the ending of the Bloody Trunk saga. For a list of our sources, see the show notes or visit our website at oldbloodpodcast.com. Plenty of photos and artifacts connected to the case will be posted on social media, so be sure to search for us on Instagram by typing in Old Blood Podcast. Music credits to Facilian Studios.